You have to envision something before you can create it. And magic is all about having a vision, having an image, and directing energy through it.
Hello, beloved listeners. This is Adrienne, writer of Stories and Songs, emergent strategist and pleasure activist, living in the land of the Shikori, Skarure, Tuscarora, Eno, and Lumbee peoples. And this is another episode of How to Survive the End of the World, our podcast about learning from apocalypse with grace, rigor, and curiosity. When I say our, I'm including my co-host and sister Autumn, who is currently on sabbatical. Have a great time, sister. In her absence, and in honor of my book Fables and Spells, I'm going full witch this season and having conversations with some of my favorite witches and teachers. I'll also read you little bits and pieces from the book each episode. Now, what I mean by witch is people who work with elements of the natural world, including our human nature, to generate more possibilities. Witching is engaging the essential natural world with magic, supernatural, and healing intention. Some names for what I'm including in this work are shamanism, sorcery, seeing, healing, herbalism, midwifery and doula labor, root work, conjuring, ritual and spell casting, astrology, divination, sound baths, altar building, song channeling, building a direct relationship with the realm of our ancestors, the spirit, the holy, the ethereal. Today, I'm really, really, really geeked out about my guest. When I imagined doing this season, this was one of the first people who came to mind. And I was like, you gotta aim high and reach for the stars and maybe you'll gather it. And today we have Starhawk here on the podcast. Hi, Starhawk.
Hi.
Starhawk is an author, activist, permaculture designer, and teacher, and a prominent voice in the modern earth-based spirituality and ecofeminism movements. Regenerative culture and permaculture are her thing. She uses ritual to align us with our earth. She is the author of 13 books, including the gorgeous utopian fiction, The Fifth Sacred Thing. And I'm really geeked out to have you here. I can't believe it. And the thing I always start off with asking people is simply, how are you right now today?
Hi, Adrienne. Hi. I'm very happy to be here and really thrilled to have a conversation with you. I really admire your work so much and especially loved emergent strategy. I think it's so important.
You. Oh, that makes my heart beat boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. And I'm good. It's a beautiful, beautiful day here. I am out in the land that is the traditional territories of the Kashaya Pomo. Mm-hmm. Sometimes called Western Sonoma County or the Casadero Hills. And, it's land that was tended by the indigenous people for tens of thousands of years, very elegantly and carefully. And it's always my hope that living here, having the incredible privilege to be a guest on this land, I can take up some of that work and help tend the land and the community. So when I'm here, that's what I spend a lot of time doing. And right now, it's just a gorgeous spring day in the woods, and things are blooming and blossoming, and the garden is absolutely going nuts after a very, very rainy winter. And you can hear, I don't know if you can hear it, but I can hear the bird song.
I hear the bird song.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like they're all like, yes, we're all here.
Yeah.
Beautiful. That is a great way and how to be in this moment. Mm-hmm. I am, I'm having a good day today. I slept well last night. Many of our listeners know I went through a major loss. A good friend of mine passed away recently.
And I'm so sorry.
Thank you. It's been decentering and recentering. And, but I was able to get outside and put food in all the bird feeders and kind of talk to my squirrel friends and put my feet on the earth. And I'm trying to do that every day. And that helps a lot. And then today I have I think I get to do 4 conversations with witches. So I'm, it's a good day. It's a really good day. So I know that I'm using the language of witch, and I also want to check in with people about how y'all, each of you, identify the work you actually do, because that word has all kinds of implications, and some people use it and some don't. So how do you identify all the kinds of work you do?
I really loved your definition of witch. It's very much aligned. I started using the word probably 40, 50 years ago when I began writing about the old religions of the goddess. Well, actually, even before that, when I was in my first year in college, for some reason, my friend Patty and I decided we were going to do this anthropology project on witches, though we knew nothing about it, though she thought her grandmother was a witch.
Oh.
And we decided we would teach a course in the experimental college, which was this thing that was set up. It was the 60s. Everyone was, you know, in full like rebellion, and it was... and set up a college sort of alongside the college where anyone could teach a class and anyone could take a class. There were no grades and no requirements, no nothing. We set up a class and a lot of people came, and we just said, we don't really know very much about witches, but we thought we'd all get together and find out. So people began researching and would come in and present something each week. And in the course of doing that, we met people who called themselves witches and said they were practicing the old religion of the goddess that went back before Christianity, even before Judaism. Mm. And I was just fascinated. You know, my background is Jewish, and I had a lot of Jewish upbringing and Hebrew school and Sunday school and even a year at the University of Judaism when I was in high school, taking after-school courses. So I had a very strong grounding in all of that. And I still, in many ways, feel very identified. You know, it's like being a Jew is something you can't really disidentify with in a world where, like, Nazis are willing to kill you.
Yeah,
and even though through most of my life that didn't seem like an imminent threat, nowadays it seems like actually a lot more, a lot less back in the 40s and more of a present reality. So
yeah.
But the idea of a goddess was just amazing to me, because the idea of like being able to see God, whatever God is, in female form was just so different from anything I had grown up with. And just the romance of the idea that this ancient tradition had survived for so long, and magic and all of that. So and even more than that, you know, they said, well, in this tradition, women can take leadership. And that was very different. You know, this was back in like 1967, 68.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, there were no women rabbis. There were very, you know, there was the feminist movement was just starting to have its second wave revival. There were no female priests, or, you know, not even very many ministers, maybe in some traditions. You know, for me, in my Jewish education, kind of going on with it, it wasn't like I could see a role for myself as a rabbi at that time. You know, it was like you could run the Hadassah, you know, the women's organization, or you could be a Hebrew school teacher. So I found that very exciting. They also said sexuality was sacred, which really struck home with me when I was 17 years old.
Yes. Yeah. And something sacred's going on.
Still does. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And so I kind of threw myself into it, and we started a coven, although we didn't really know what we were doing, and started doing ritual. I also, at that point, got involved in a feminist consciousness raising group. Okay. And with there was a women's center that had opened in Venice, California, where I lived at the time. And I walked in there and for the first meeting, because that summer I'd stumbled across Kate Millett's Sexual Politics and read it when I had the flu one day in a youth hostel in Frankfurt. Stayed in and read the book, and I just found it illuminating. You know, again, I think it's really hard for younger women to even conceive of, like, the consciousness back then. But, you know, I was an art major at the time, and in the art department, 70% of the undergraduates were women, 30% of the graduate students were women. There was only one woman professor in the entire department, and she taught weaving. I remember one of my photography professors overhearing him say to someone else, you know, "Oh, I hate teaching women because they're just going to get married and paint in their garage."
Wow.
And, you know, that was bad enough. But when I look back on it, my inner response to that was, "Oh, yes, those stupid women, they're just going to get married and paint in their garage. I'm not one of them.
I'm not like that."
Yeah, I'm not like that. And so discovering the feminist movement, kind of going like, oh, maybe it's not those stupid women. Maybe it's actually a whole social organization. You know, maybe the reason they're painting in the garage is because there's no women professors in the art department. Maybe those are linked together.
Yes.
You know, right. And maybe I would do better to consciously identify with other women than to subconsciously identify with men as the center and the protagonist of every story.
And I love that.
I think that was a huge process that went on for so many of us, and we called consciousness raising.
Yeah.
Because it was, and a lot of that early movement was centered around forming circles where women would get together and meet every week, and we'd have a topic where we, you know, it might be your mother, it might be your work, it might be school, but you'd have a chance to speak about it without being interrupted and without being challenged, because we had noticed how often in life women get interrupted and talked over. And that was a very powerful experience. So we had a group that became a very close-knit group, partly because, you know, we had real crises to deal with. You know, one of our women had a huge mental health crisis and attempted suicide and was in mental hospital. Another woman in the group developed early breast cancer and actually died quite early. So our consciousness raising group, we did do some rituals together. And it seemed like there was kind of an overlap between a coven or a circle, you know, ritual circle, consciousness raising group.
I think there's a huge overlap.
Yeah. And then my life changed. You know, I was in my early 20s. I split up with my boyfriend. I dropped out of school. I went traveling for a year. And it became kind of like a spiritual quest in some ways. And when I came back, I decided I wanted to move to Northern California. And I did, and then met up with other people who were witches and who were starting to explore at that point the history of religion as related to feminism. Religion all around us was so patriarchal and so male dominated.
Yeah.
And we were asking, was there ever anything different? Is there anything different? And we, of course, discovered, yes, there is. Obviously, there are many indigenous traditions where women have very powerful roles and are leaders and are culture makers and healers. And we also discovered, if you go back far enough, even in the roots of European culture, there are these earth-based traditions where women were the healers and often the visionaries and the leaders. And then that brought us around to understanding the role of the witchcraft trials and the way that that was very consciously stamped out in Europe. So deciding to call ourselves witches was really consciously, it was a way both of reclaiming the word and identifying with the women and the men, because there were also men who were persecuted in those trials.
Oh, yeah.
But also understanding the way that word, you know, that word was used as, I think, a way to stop people thinking.
Yes.
You know, you say the word witch, and it creates this image of a powerful woman who is dangerous and probably evil.
Mm-hmm.
And to counter that, and to say, Carol Christ, who was one of the writers and thinkers on all of this, said basically, you know, the goddess is the image of beneficent female power.
Yes.
And understanding how few of those images there are in our culture, other than things like the mother,
right,
and the Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
But to have female power that was not just nurturing, but was also had agency and also could express anger and also could express determination and setting a goal and following it and taking on responsibility and leading.
Yeah.
You know, those things were always suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And still are.
I think that's a big part of, like what led to this book and this podcast and kind of this claiming, this exploration is, you know, things circle back around. And I'm like, I want to be mindful of not letting boxes be closed that have already been blown open and not letting spaces be taken, not giving, ceding territory that has already been liberated and wants to stay that way, you know, within ourselves and without. And, you know, I hear so much in how you came to it that was like, we didn't know, you know, we were trying, we were experimenting, and we were studying, we were learning. And I wonder if at any point there was like, oh, this is the formal lineage of my work, or these are the people that I'm going to claim as my teachers, or the folks who are really pointing me towards the rituals, or was it more intuitive, you know?
When I moved to the Bay Area in 1975, there was a community here that was already much more open and well organized. You know, at that time, most witch groups were pretty much secret and hidden. And of course, it was long before the internet. It was really difficult to find people. There were a few books you could find.
Yeah.
You know, every now and then there was an occult bookstore. Or I had run into witches, our original teachers, first at the Renaissance Fair. I had started teaching a class through an open university in San Francisco when I got there. And one day a woman named Chandria walked in and said, "Hi, I'm from the New Reformed Order of the Orthodox Golden Dawn, and we're here to check you out." I was like, "Oh, like, oh no, the little witches have found me out."
Yeah, that's awesome.
And she invited me to a ritual, and our little group, our class, like we went as kind of a class outing. And I remember being really somewhat terrified, saying like, "Okay, they start sacrificing babies, we're out of there," right?
You got to have your standards. You got to have your line. Yeah.
But we went, and here we're like, there must have been 100 people in this beautiful park with a gorgeous altar. And, you know, I just remember like huge baskets of moon cookies, and just, it was like something out of a dream for me, you know, the kind of thing you envision happening that I had never seen in real life before. And we had this ritual, and I was just floating for days. It was so wonderful. So I got connected to their group, and they had actually organized a group called the Covenant of the Goddess that had applied and gotten standing as a 501c3, as a recognized religious organization.
Oh, wow.
You know, of course, in the United States, you know, the entity that decides whether or not you're a real religion is, of course, the IRS.
Yep.
And so I got involved with that, and met other witches, and met Victor and Cora Anderson from the fairy tradition, began studying with them. And I'd say reclaiming, which is a tradition ultimately that I co-founded.
Yeah.
It's kind of an amalgam. We learned a lot from Victor and Cora, but by then we were already sort of on our own path of creating ritual. We have very strong feminist and activist roots, so we tended to be non-hierarchical and do everything by consensus rather than having like a high priestess in charge of everything.
It's so cool. It feels like time traveling with you. And I can see it. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, I can kind of feel and see this time. It's fun. The other night I went to see Stevie Nicks in concert. Here, and it was like, it felt like that, like time traveling too. I'm like, oh yes, this is like a particular sound and a particular feel. So nowadays, what are some of the ways you do your witch work, like in a day in the life of Starhawk? How does the witchy work show up?
Well, Reclaiming now is still an organization that now has branches all over the world. And it's still decentralized and non-hierarchical, so I don't run it. I have involvement in some aspects of it, but other people taking it on and do things like witch camps and public rituals and classes and teaching. I teach ritual sometimes with reclaiming. I also have some online teaching, like a ritual skills class I've been doing, and generally have some kind of online ritual thing happening since COVID. Personally, like I wake up in the morning, like this morning, and come out here and do a little bit of yoga or stretching and do some healing meditations for people. And also just some sitting and watching and listening, and, you know, listening to the bird song and watching what's happening, kind of opening up, giving the natural world a chance to talk to me. And that's part of my daily practice. I think it's really helpful to have some kind of daily practice in your life, a way of grounding and centering. And as a writer, as a person who spends a lot of time in my own internal imagery, I find it's really helpful to have a practice that takes me out of my head rather than more into my head. Yeah, so it's really about opening up and watching and looking and listening. And then I'd spend a lot of time teaching permaculture, which to me is kind of the how-to part of believing the earth is sacred. We have an organization, Earth Activist Training, that teaches permaculture and regenerative design, both online and in person. So a lot of my time is taken up with teaching, with all the stuff of running a nonprofit, and with doing stuff on the land, right? Gardening, forestry work, all of the stuff that you do when you're actually tending the land.
I love that. The stewarding, tending, loving the land, and being loved by it sounds like.
Hello, beloved survivors. It's me, Autumn. So, as you know, our show does not run ads. That's intentional. We are brought to you entirely by you, by your support, you cute, sexy thing. If you support us on Patreon already, thank you. You're awesome. I'm not talking to you. If you don't support us on Patreon already, I'm talking to you, and now is a great time to consider joining. We've got t-shirts, we've got tote bags, we have mugs, we have original art by my sistre, and also Adrian and I do these really fun Ask Us Anything episodes, which are exclusively available to patrons, and where we answer questions that are exclusively sourced from patrons. So, to become a patron today and support the longevity of this show, please go to patreon.com/endoftheworldshow. Thank you. Okay, let's get back into it.
Do you still write fiction? Do you still find yourself writing often, or how do you feel like that's slid back a little bit in the...
It's slid back a little for me in the last couple of years. I would have thought with COVID I'd write more, but actually running our organization has taken up so much of my time and mental space. I haven't done as much writing as I would have thought, but I have been writing a series of short stories. There's now a genre. Like, my stuff never had a genre before. It wasn't exactly science fiction, but now there's this genre of solar punk, right?
Solar punk. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, you know, positive visions of the future. Which for me is really important, both as a writer and as a witch.
Yeah.
You know, one of our magical understandings is that you have to envision something before you can create it. And magic is all about creating, having a vision, having an image, and directing energy through it.
That's right.
And so the fifth sacred thing, which was my solar punk novel, right?
Yes.
And I wrote actually 30 years ago, was both about having a positive vision of the future, and also, I think, you know, futuristic fiction always has a tendency to warn, right? And, you know, what would happen if we continue on the negative trends, and then what happens when they collide?
Yes. You
know, how does the peaceable, balanced, diverse society defend itself without having to turn into a warlike hierarchy?
Yeah.
So, but I've been writing a series, some short stories for Solar Punk magazine, and one's in an anthology called Bioluminescence.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of set in a future where there's the religious order of regenerators.
Wow.
Groups that have decided to become like the conscious regenerators of ecosystems and landscapes. But each one of them has a different take on how to construct gender. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's one where gender is a verb. And it's not really, It's something you do. It's not an identity so much.
Got it.
And the story is really about the clash with the younger generation who grew up that way, has internalized that, and the older generation that's still in reaction. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one where people still really love all the old gender roles, but they change every 6 months. Everyone switches gender.
Oh, great. That's very Le Guin. I love that.
It's kind of like a rom-com. You know? Mm-hmm. What happens to your relationship if you suddenly switch genders in the middle of it? Right?
That's fun. Yeah. Seems like it could be fun.
So I have in mind to write some more of those and maybe eventually put them together into a book.
I love that. There's also, I've been judging this contest that is introducing, it's sort of like the genre is cli-fi, climate fiction. Uh-huh. And I feel like your work also fits, could fit easily in that space, and really trying as much as we can to elicit these, right, positive or beneficent imaginations of what the future could look like, and at least trying to imagine ourselves surviving and feeling compelled by our survival. You know, I'm a student of Octavia Butler and Ursula Le Guin, and like, I love The Fifth Sacred Thing. I love, you know, getting people to ideate together as well, just to be like, okay, you know, we don't have to write it all down, but what do we imagine is possible for this land or this community or this relationship or this place? So, but it also makes sense to me. I think that the work it takes to run organizations actually does occupy a lot of that same space. Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot of people I know who are like writers, but it's on the back burner while they, you know, while they do, while they organize. And
felt for me, you know, doing and organizing is important. It kind of feeds the writing.
Exactly.
But I'm actually trying to shift it now so I can maybe do less and have more mental space to get back to writing more.
Same. I just today was telling a friend, I think it's time to get off of social media again. Uh-huh. And I was like, sometimes it's a really lovely space to connect with people, but sometimes it gets a little like, oh, wait, I'm thinking in these short stints, or I'm thinking in memes, or I'm thinking in reaction. And it's time to gather my energy back and see what wants to be. I've been like, how I do keep wanting to build some connection between the mass shootings and the moment that we are in with the earth. You know, to me, I just keep finding these places where I'm like, oh, there's a vigilante justice that is moving in us right now that continues to disconnect us from home. So I love that mental space. I'm pro. What if you were to name a few of the skills and practices that you have been in your lifelong witchiness, what are some of those skills that you wish everyone actually had access to in this apocalyptic time?
You know, one of the core magical skills is grounding. It's just making a connection with the earth. And bringing yourself fully present into the moment. And I'm sure you know Rezma Menachem's book, My Grandmother's Hands.
Obsessed.
It's a wonderful book about really confronting trauma. And it really struck me how much of what he says there relates to what we do magically in terms of how do you settle your body. And how do you respond to somebody who's in trauma or in that state of agitation and violence? Yeah. Well, it helps to have a settled body. And what he means is really what we say about grounding. You know, it's breathing. It's really getting an energy flow that moves through you and that connects you to the earth. Just like, you know, having that extra little prong on your refrigerator cord, like helps it handle more energy.
Yeah.
So I think that's very useful. And it's something I've taught you know, for many, many years, I was training activists to do nonviolent direct action and sometimes to go into very dangerous situations with riot cops or in Palestine where there were, you know, going up against the military and people were really literally getting shot and killed. Yes. Yes. And that grounding will help make you safe in a dangerous situation because it will help keep you from going into reaction and just purely panicking and keep you in a state where you can make a conscious choice about what you want to do.
That's so good.
I also think it's important to have an actual relationship with nature, you know, to not just think about it as something you watch on the Discovery Channel, but to actually spend time. And that doesn't have to be out in the pristine forest. It could be, you know, spending some time every day looking at what's growing in the cracks in the pavement in the vacant lot behind your house.
Yeah,
because probably there will be some healing herbs poking out of that pavement.
That's right. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And that's partly why I do teach permaculture to people is understanding that we as humans can have a beneficial interaction with the natural world. Yeah. And in fact, to deal with climate change, you know, I often think of we think of climate change not just about a bunch of carbon numbers, but as massive ecosystem degeneration.
Yeah.
Then the response to it has to be massive ecosystem regeneration.
Yeah.
And the hopeful thing is we actually know how to do that.
Yeah.
We have examples all around us of people who've done that, sometimes on a massive scale. It can happen much more quickly sometimes than people envision.
Yeah.
And it's very, very hopeful.
It's so hopeful. I think so too. It amazes me too that so much of regeneration is like step back and let the earth guide. You know, it's like the earth is very, 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 very skilled at regeneration and we can partner with her, dance with her in that work. I really love that. Mm. These are good. These are good, people. You hear these? Yeah. These are doable.
So, well, that's the thing about climate. Like, I think we often look at climate through what's unconsciously a kind of Christian asceticism worldview that, like, we have to atone for our climate sins by being punished and by giving things up and, you know, by not enjoying things. Actually, what we need to do around climate are nice things.
Right? Yes.
You know, we need to switch from nasty, polluting fossil fuels that horrifically oppress people in the lands where they're extracted to clean, renewable sources of energy.
Yeah. You know, they're good for all of us.
We have to start growing food in ways that actually heal the soil instead of poisoning the food that we eat. We have to spend maybe less time acquiring things, but more time actually with community, with friends, with family, with neighbors. You know, we have to have clean water and clean air and beautiful natural systems. Like, where's the downside in that?
I know. It always befuddles me. I'm just sort of like, it's just clearly better this way. but, you know, I think there's also something about power that I'm like, when you experience what it feels like to have power with other people, power that doesn't denigrate or erase, I think that that kind of power is orgasmic and wondrous and interconnected. But I think that until people experience it, they don't believe, you know, they're like, this, there's only one way to feel power and it's to dominate. And I think there's something, you know, there's something in that, that I feel like I keep trying to be an invitation to. It's like, what does it look like to have that power with the people that you love, the power with the people we share this planet with?
I think that's so important in building our movements because you know, we have to have movements that protest against things because there's just so much going wrong, right? We
That's
have
right.
to stand up sometimes and say no, but our movements are always more powerful when they also embody a yes, and where they give people an opportunity to experience that feeling of doing something together. I mean,
exactly.
Been involved in a lot of the mobilizations in the global justice movement, and part of what made them so powerful is we have a convergence. People would come together and we'd essentially set up like a little mini city for a few days where there were roles for everybody to do something and to contribute. And to contribute, you know, maybe you were not going to be a good street activist and run around and face down the riot cops, but maybe you're going to be a fantastic cook and feed everybody.
Yes, there's always a role. Yeah.
You know, people have some very core needs. And I think when movements, I think one of the reasons we're seeing this total meltdown of our culture, which is the mass shootings, I think, are a symptom of mm-hmm. our massive cultural dysfunction.
Yes.
Is that our culture is no longer providing people a sense of belonging to something worth belonging to.
That's right.
Of being seen and valued, of having agency, being able to have an impact on the world in a positive way.
Yes.
And a sense of meaning and purpose. And I think a movement at its best does that.
Exactly. Yeah. I think of that all the time, that movement yeah. has to be a sanctuary for that part of us that seeks belonging. And mm-hmm. that's also part of the earth piece. Because I'm like, when you connect to the earth, the belonging is a direct connection, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm like,
right.
just yeah. go. Like, you already belong here. You already belong to this place. And mm-hmm. Everything belongs here already. And what we're trying to do is remove these constructs that make us believe otherwise. I do have a last question for you, mm-hmm. which is kind of a personal one. So, you know, I've always in these moments where folks are like, oh, you know things and you've got some mm-hmm. wisdom and stuff. And then I'll be going through my own healing journey still. You know, I'm going through right now, I'm really turning and looking at how the patterns of disordered eating have shown up in my life and what mm-hmm. they're connected to. And for someone who really seeks to be present, how much numbness still has a function in my life. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that keeps me from being able to be a very healing witch, but mm-hmm. I'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts on that, like what it takes to be able to make a good offer of your witch work while you're still doing your own healing.
Well, I think that healing is a lifelong process. It's a never-ending process. So
yeah.
there's never a point where you're fully healed.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be in order to be a healer. It's a, you know, it's a very powerful archetype of the wounded healer that
yeah.
we heal out of, to some extent, out of our own wounds, because that's how we understand the process.
Yeah.
And how we learn compassion. So I've heard people kind of in the New Age movement for decades going like, you know, well, I thought that in order to work for peace, I had to make peace within myself. And I've always said like, well, you know, again, like, it's not like you get to some point in life where you've made peace within yourself and then you can go out and try to make it in the world.
Right.
Part of the way you make peace within yourself is through that engagement with the work of doing it in the world. And I think it's the same with healing. If you feel that you have something to offer, I think it's helpful to have a discernment process
yes.
where you can sit for a moment and just say, what am I offering? Is this something that's been asked for? Mm-hmm. Is this something that is welcome? Or is this coming out of my own need to be a healer?
Ah, I love that.
Yeah. And usually it's at least some part of it is coming out of your own need to be healer. Like, that's okay. Like,
yeah,
you know, but as long as the bulk of it is really responding to a need, mm-hmm. And being able to set aside some of that and knowing kind of where your own wounds are and where they might create distortions in your perception of somebody else's.
I love that. I really love that. I feel like a lot of it, one of the other witches was talking about cartography, that it's like part of it is you're learning how to be responsible for mapping that landscape within yourself, and then you can help others traverse it. And I really have been feeling that lately, that I'm like, oh, like everything in my life that I have turned and healed, I know I've been able to pull the tincture, you know, pull that tincture and just be like, okay, now this medicine is something that I can pass on through, you know, it's come through my body, and now it's going to come out as usually words, you know, but it'll come out in the way it's meant to. That's really helpful, Starhawk. Thank you. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you want to make sure you share or say?
Well, I did want to share one story. You know, when the big mobilization was happening at Standing Rock, I went there. I was only able to go for a short time over that Thanksgiving weekend. But, you know, my whole life I had been writing about how the spiritual and the political are connected, and that your activism needs to be grounded in spirit if it's going to be sustainable, and your spirituality needs to be grounded in activism in the actual world. And to walk into that space and see at the very entrance a big sign that said, this is a place of prayer and sanctuary, and feel this so powerfully, you know, it wasn't even like bringing them together. It was like they had never been separated. Was really tremendously affirming for me personally. And I was invited to a women's sweat that was poured by Lila June, who's an amazing indigenous singer and activist. And went up there in the cold and the dawn, and, you know, I looked at her and she was wearing a t-shirt that said Boudica on it. Well, Boudica was the Celtic chieftain, a woman chieftain, back when the Romans were taking over Britain, who had led a rebellion against the Romans, almost won, but had started it when her daughters were raped. And she's a very powerful female image. And Lila started talking about discovering her own Swedish heritage from that side of her family, and the witch persecutions, and how important it was for her to recover that piece of history and to understand what had happened in Europe. You know, that part of the healing that we need to do is the fact that Europe turned against its healers and massacred them. And it really came to me, you know, that there's a lot of talk about, you know, dealing with white people and indigenous people and what had to happen. And it really came to me that white people can't heal unless we understand the witch persecutions, unless we understand this concerted, powerful effort to stamp out that deep connection with the earth and those remnants of women's power in Europe that create this psychic chasm within us when we start to approach those things. And you know, I had done a lot of writing about that back in the 80s in my book Dreaming the Dark, and exploring the history of it. And there's also some wonderful books by Sylvia Federici. Caliban and the Witch. Where she really identifies how that process was important to severing the connections that European culture had with the land, the kind of indigenous relations that were still left and still remnants of them.
Yes.
In order to kind of, well, what it did was it opened the way for unfettered capitalism. And yes. I think about that a lot now when we see this upsurge of white Christian nationalism that's reviving this tremendously old stuff that's determined to reinforce the oldest, strictest gender roles. You know, that's rooted in racism, mm-hmm. and including anti-Semitism, which is a form of racism.
Mm-hmm.
In order to maintain those structures of power and to counter that, I think we need to understand, I think it was Einstein or somebody who said, you can't change a system, you know, if you think in the same way with the same thinking.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
This is the core crucial thing.
Yeah.
I feel like more than anything else is I think of it as dominance thinking, you know,
yeah.
supremacy thinking. Right.
And I think too often in the movement, we end up, you know, using dominance thinking to try to enforce.
Yep. We're like, we're going to get free. I'm in charge. Right. I'm like,
yeah. And yeah. So, you know, if you say something the wrong way, I'm going to throw you out of this group. Right.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
I mean, there's so much of that stuff around cancel culture that's just pure right wing propaganda, but there are some seeds of truth in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think to counter it, we need to build a movement that is welcoming and that consciously says, how do we meet those needs? How do we give people, you know, it's easy to give people a sense of belonging by saying we belong, you don't, right?
That's right. It's actually much more complex to be like, in all your wholeness, you belong. And how do we actually create structures that can hold it all?
And how do we give people a chance to really be seen and valued in the fullness of who they are?
Mm-hmm.
That might include those identities, but where we understand that we're all a complex mix of identities. You know, you might be thinking of one friend of mine who always says, I'm not a spiritual Indian, right? Don't ask me to like open with a prayer. Like,
I'm not that girl. That's me. I'm always like, I'd rather be playing video games, but I will do this for y'all, you know? I love that. I really do. And it also feels very resonant with like allowing people to be whole in this time. And mm-hmm. we are so much more comfortable in so many ways if we're like, oh, you're fitting into the role that I've cast you in.
Yeah.
And it's so much more chaotic to be with the world as it is, where everyone's changing roles all the time. But
yeah,
thank you, Starhawk, so much for taking time to sit with me. I feel like I could ask you questions for weeks and weeks and weeks and continuously be nourished by the stories and the conversation. Thank you for your long life of witchy, excellent activism and organizing and loving the land. I'm going to read a poem, not a long poem, a short poem from Fables and Spells to close us out. This one is called A Complex Movement, and it was also an emergent strategy, so you might actually have seen it before.
Mm.
Over and over again, it becomes known the peace we seek is seeking us, the joy, a full bud awaiting our attention. Justice in our hands longing to be practiced, the whole world learning from within. This thrilling moat in the universe, laboratory labyrinth. Internalize demands. You are the one you are waiting for. Externalize love. Bind us together into a greater self, a complex movement, a generative abundance, an embodied evolution. Learn to be here. Critique is a seductress. Her door is always open. So what if you get some? We are going further, past reform, to wonder. This requires comprehension that cannot fit in words. Out beyond our children, beyond the end of time, there is a ceaseless cycle, a fractal of sublime, and we come to create it, to soil our hands and faces, loving, loving, and loving ourselves and all our places.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Shake these bones, shake these bones, oh God, shake.
That's
these
beautiful.
Bones,
thank you.
Thank you. I'm so grateful for this time. And I'm grateful to all of our listeners for tuning in. Our episode was produced by the beautiful man, Zach Rosen. We are on patreon.com at End of the World Show if you want to support what you're hearing. You can also find us on Instagram at End of the World PC. Thank y'all. Thank you.